The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Signed you the three articles of Bollenhoven, The Significance of Calvinism for the Reformation of Philosophy, and those three articles, there are two copies of them, they are on reserve in folders for this course. And then I'm going to ask you not too many more things, but just a very few, in fact. I do want you to read the little pamphlet of Van Til, Why I Believe in God. And you've probably done that before, but that is an additional assignment. But be sure that you will have read then these other ones. The Why I Believe in God is not on reserve. If you think it should be, why, just let me know. I think you probably each will if you have a copy. Well, last time we looked at Dooyeweerd, began to look at Dooyeweerd very briefly, gave certain ideas about his development. I began to explore the idea of his philosophy as a Christian transcendental philosophy. And to my mind, that is the only way to understand it. And by that I said I don't mean the transcendental critique in the step-by-step form he developed it later on, but I do regard it as a kind of philosophy that was, or philosophizing, that was his from the very beginning. And I say that it had a transcendental thrust, and that was from the beginning, and it got its final form then only later. Now, I'll review that idea why it is transcendental a little bit later this evening, so I'll not go through that again. But I was mentioning that Dooyeweerd, as well as Bollenhoven, developed a theory of the law spheres. Unlike Bollenhoven, he did not talk about this and that and thus and so, but simply about the modes or the how. It's not a concrete what, but how things appear in contrast to a concrete what. They are related to one another by anticipations, retrospations. He used that terminology regularly. I also mentioned, however, how he used the term analogy in a broad sense to refer both to the anticipations and retrospations. Out of the literature, I have lifted two terms, protensional and retentional. You find, for example, in Spiegelberg's Philosophy and Psychology, you find the word protensional. And I found the word retentional also in phenomenologically oriented literature. So those are current terms which one might indeed use, but they are not used, to my knowledge, in any of the literature itself of the Calvinistic philosophy. Now, Dooyeweerd, as I said, called these both together analogies. In our naive experiencing, these aspects are held together in what he called a systatic unity. There's a standing togetherness of these things, but in theory, they are distinguished and set apart from each other. And as I said, Dooyeweerd has characteristically distinguished 14 aspects near the end of his career, 15, at least in the total history of it. If I have it straight, there were originally 15 that were distinguished, then it was reduced to 14, and then again expanded to 15. But there is no reason within this philosophy why it might not be more or less. There's no magic to this number, 14 or 15. It's just a matter of investigating reality as it is and coming up according to your best judgment as to how many aspects it has. According to this criterion, as I said, that if you do not properly observe the boundaries in God's creation, What happens is that there comes what is called antinomy, or a contradictoriness as to the law. Law side, which cannot then be simply eliminated by becoming more consistent. The only way you can eliminate it is to give proper attention to the boundaries within God's cosmos. So it is according to the principle of the exclusion of antinomies that these aspects are found. Well, there is then a whole series of them. I have referred to them when talking about Bollenhoven. Hope I have enough string here so I can get over here. But you have, for example, the arithmetical, the spatial, physical, energetic effect, biotical, psychical, logical, and so forth, and so on, with these down here being the non-normative ones, up to then the logical, and below, and then up here above here you have then the normative aspects, namely that here you cannot say that, let us say, some animal is normative. His actions are normative. He simply follows the instinct. You cannot say, except with reference to man and his desires, that a wolf is bad for attacking the sheep or something like that. The wolf just has to eat. And but up there, including the logical, you have the normative aspects. Now, let me just say a few things about this theory. We don't have to go through the whole list of them again. We'll be touching upon one or another. But I did that before, so let's not bother with it right now. But let's simply review a few things in terms of D'Oyver's position as to these law spheres. There is here a cosmological expression of the principle of sphere sovereignty. I mentioned that Kuiper was the one who really, for the first time, developed the idea of sphere sovereignty per se. You have Kuiper. He was, however, preceded by Althusius. Some say that in Althusius you find really the sphere sovereignty idea, or at least a very definite anticipation of it. If you look at Calvin's view of calling and some of Calvin's ideas, there is a suggestion already of the idea of sphere sovereignty. But it was not in Kuiper, it was not in any of these men, that this got a cosmological expression, as it does here. Both then in the idea of individuality structures, that is something which this philosophy has developed, but also an extension of this idea of sphere sovereignty to the various modes or the various aspects of reality. Now, some people have been questioning whether or not this is a legitimate extension. And I don't know all the ins and outs of that argument, because I haven't been made privy to all of it, but I have run into some of it. I think one of the major objections is that you do not find the theory of sphere sovereignty per se, or these various modal aspects, in the scriptures. Well, if that is your argument, I would have to ask whether or not you are too much a biblicist, because you do not find really any Christian philosophy in the sense that you would find this philosophy, let us say, simply in the scriptures, and it does not pretend to be a scriptural philosophy simply in that sense. It's supposed to be conformable to the scriptures. It's supposed to live out of the scriptures. But it is a human attempt, in the best way possible, in the light of God's revelation, to explore the cosmos and to find out its structure. And it discovers, according to its best lights, that there is then this sovereignty in its own sphere, and it finds, according to its best lights, that this is also able to be extended to the modal aspects. And as far as this biblicism situation is concerned, Calvin was not a biblicist in that sense, and I don't feel awkward about being in the camp with Calvin. Well, then, if we look at the various aspects, then Dooyeweerd would say that they have fundamental, irreducible nuclei of meaning. There is a nucleus of meaning of each one. There is a nuclei of meaning. Sometimes he has translated it into English, kernel. I never have gotten quite used to that. Reminds me of corn and the cob more than anything else, I'm afraid. But that there is a kernel of meaning. And I believe that word originates with Dooyeweerd. I don't know anyone else to blame for it. And I don't like it particularly, but it has gotten into the literature and into the vocabulary. I prefer such a term as nucleus, or the nuclei of meaning. Now, in other words, in each of these, there is a central center, let us say, or nucleus of meaning, which is irreducible then to any other. And it shows then that it has its sovereignty in its own sphere. Now, this nucleus is not logical in character. You would expect that then in terms of what we have said, because we have said that the cosmos, according to this position, is not logically qualified. It is not logically qualified as a whole. These nuclei are not logical in character. In fact, they resist logical analysis. As one seeks to analyze in a theoretical fashion what is here, as he seeks then to get a logical concept of the nucleus, of the various spheres, he will run against, then he will bump up against a resistance. That they are not logical in character, they resist logical analysis, and this, according to Dooyeweerd, is an expression of their sovereignty in their own sphere. But, he says in the fourth place, there's not only the sovereignty of each in its own sphere. It's not only that each one has its own irreducible nucleus of meaning, you might say, but that there is a universality in its own sphere. That each one, from its own perspective, so there's not only the sovereignty in its own sphere, but there is a universality in its own sphere of every aspect. That each aspect, from its own perspective, reflects the entire cosmos, the entire aspectual fabric, you might say, or web of the entire cosmos. So there are anticipating and retrospecting moments, what he calls analogical moments. And so if we look at it on this diagram here, we'd have to say this, that in the psychical, for example, or the biotical, let's take that because we have a little bit more room here, then you have your nucleus of meaning. There's a nucleus of meaning, but clustered around this nucleus of meaning, there are subsidiary moments of meaning that point either in anticipating or analogical or retrospecting direction. So when Dooyeweerd said, now we look at this, we attempt to get certain concepts, and what happens then? We find that we obtain general logical concepts. General logical concepts. Get space, life, and so on, and so on. Now the question comes, how do we distinguish those from something else? Dooyeweerd says, as soon as we get one of these general logical concepts, we discover that it is analogical in character. It is multivocal in character. Analogical in character, it is then has a certain, well, I sometimes have used the word ambiguity. I was talking with Dr. Evan Runner not long ago, and he suggested, no, that isn't a very good word. Multivocality is better, that it speaks in a way with many voices. You talk about space, and we've already given this type of illustration. You have then to qualify it. What do you mean? Space in its original sense? Do you mean auditory space, which would be psychical? Are you talking about social space? What are you talking about? You have to qualify it according to one or another of the modes. Now, the multivocality then does not arise because the meaning has not been clarified in a logical analysis. One might say, all right, you've got an ambiguity situation here. Let's just clarify it by further logical analysis. As I've suggested, that's not the idea at all. It is not because things have not been cleaned up logically, you might say, have not yet been clarified in a logical analysis, but because it is being used in a sense that goes beyond its original basic sense. That is, if I have space, then if I look in terms of the biotical, then I have space again, but it is life space or biotic space, Lebensraum, or we might talk about habitat or environment in that point of view, habitat for the animal, for example. That would be a life space. As talking about a social, we talk about Lebensraum, or as the Germans called it anyway. You would have the sensitive. You could have the psychical space, as I mentioned, auditory space would be that. But you are using it in terms of a later aspect. You're using it in a sense other than its original basic sense, in connection with a later aspect of the cosmos, and it has then an analogical, it has a multivocal character. And Dooyeweerd says then, if you're going then to form your concepts well, if you're going to form them in a clear fashion, you must make these distinctions. You must then see that your theorizing depends upon a basic structure of the cosmos. And so you have then the nucleus of meaning in the sixth place. You have the nuclei of meaning, let us say. You have the analogies. And then, even as Vollenhoven, in each one of these aspects, you have the law side. And on the subject side, you have both subject and object. So for each one, you will have the law, and then under that, on the subject side, subject to the law, you have both subject and object. And we were talking about that with respect to Vollenhoven, you will remember, that then there is a particularization of the law with respect to every one of these aspects, and the subject is not set over against the world, let us say, as this object, but there's a particular character or a particular qualification of the subject-object relationship within each of these aspects. Now, this occurs against the background also that there's a fundamental character of the reality as meaning, that all reality is meaning. And this not in the strict sense of a symbolic meaning. It does not mean then, I'm using the word mean here in this symbolic sense. It does not mean symbolically that it means something in a symbolic sense. It is a sense that that to express the self-insufficiency of the temporal world, or the lack of self-sufficiency of the temporal world with respect to its origin. I have sometimes put it this way. I have attempted to use the illustration of the artichoke. Now, I did insist the other night that I was anything but a cook, and my wife insists on keeping up the illusion because she didn't even trust me the other day to put the water. Also, she did trust me to turn the thermostat to 300 and put the chicken in the oven the other day. So I guess maybe I have graduated into something. But nevertheless, I have used, however, the illustration of the artichoke. And if we think of the heart of the artichoke, and the heart of an artichoke does not look quite like that, I shall grant you, then if you think then of God's revelation, then That then, God in his revelation speaks then to the heart of man. But as man then from his heart relates to the world, if we draw little lines down from this heart and in various directions, like sort of like a little moon landing craft or something like that, then what you have to do is to see that as you are out, going out to the world, and your heart stands, that each one of these lines, as it were curls back, just like the leaves of an artichoke here. And so that as we have God speaking to our hearts and our lives radiating out toward the world, at the same time there is this reflection upon ourselves and upon our heart stance in everything that we do. There is then a lack of self-sufficiency, that we are dependent upon the cosmos, that then, however, every part of that cosmos reflects the glory of God, the Creator, that we are constantly reflecting upon ourselves in our own lives, in our covenant responsibility, in our covenant position before God. Now, if that illustration of the artichoke is helpful, it has helped some people at least, and it might very well put this in a light that is concrete and is able to be remembered more easily. This idea of the meaning character of all reality is set up then against the idea of substance. Substance interpreted this way, as something has is sufficient to itself. The only one of whom Dooyeweerd was willing to say that he was self-sufficient is God. God is indeed, if you want to talk that way, is substance, that namely he is sufficient to himself. But the cosmos is meaning. It's not that it has meaning, as if there were something then that had meaning, but it is meaning. It's not something tacked on, something added on, something which qualifies it, but it is meaning in all of its part. And so there's the denial then that any part of the cosmos is a substance, namely that it is isolated from the religious center of man's being. There's nothing in the cosmos, nothing that we do, which is isolated then from the central direction toward God, as that then is funneled, you might say, through the heart of man. So the idea of constantly living in the light of the revelation of God, going out in our heart stance, relating to all of the world as a total being, but yet reflecting upon ourselves and God through our self-consciousness. So, as Calvin says, we know God as we know ourselves, and we know ourselves as we know God. But we're looking at this question then of this position as a transcendental philosophy, and we have then looked at some of the early things here. Let's look then for a moment at Dooyeweerd's move to a formalization of the transcendental critique. Let's look at this move toward the formalization of the transcendental critique. Now, I indicated to you last time that I thought that there were tendencies in this direction, that the original orientation of Dooyeweerd's thinking made it virtually a necessity that he should land up with a transcendental philosophy and with a transcendental critique. And I'll try to put some flesh on that notion again this evening. I said from the very beginning, Dooyeweerd attempted to find the relevancy of his Calvinistic world and life view for the science of statecraft, Staatkunde. He was working in the Kuiper Foundation, and he had the time to study. He would do the work of the foundation in clipping out things and arranging things for their little groups in their Kiesvereinigung, as they are called, in the little cells, the political cells that would be operative in the various towns of Holland, the cities of Holland. Then he would enter into his study and study the principles and attempt to see the relevancy of his worldview for a Christian statecraft. But I said, and this is characteristic of Dooyeweerd, that you do not lift theoretical concepts simply out of the scriptures. You cannot simply lift theoretical schemes out of the scriptures. He agreed with Vollenhoven that the scriptures are written in a pre-theoretical, very concrete, living language, and do not have then the character of theoretical writings. Dooyeweerd, to add to that notion just a little bit, had the idea then that theory has its own identity with regard to naive experience. Theory has its own identity. That would go for theology too, or chemistry, or physics, or whatever. All theoretical work has its own identity, it has its own structure, over against naive experience. And on the naive experience side, you'd have worldview. So you have to distinguish your theoretical work on science and philosophy from your worldview and from your naive speech, as also you find it in the scriptures. But I also insisted that all theory then has to be conformable to God's word at its very root. It's not derived just from that word, but it has to be conformable then. Well, if that be so, I think you can see that given your theory, given your theoretical conceptualization, given your theologizing, given your chemistry thinking, given your physics, given your economics, and so on and so on and so on, you haven't simply drawn your theory out of the Bible, but you have to, as it were, spiral down in these sciences to find in the depth dimension, transcendentally, to find their religious foundations. Because every theory will have a religious root. Every theory will be religiously founded. So you have to spiral down in it, in the concept, to see what is already at work in it, and then to have this transcendental reflection on what is already at work in your theorization. And it is on this level, on the level of the root questions, on what you find down there, on the presuppositions of your theory, it is there that you get your conformity or lack of conformity with Scripture. Namely, is it, then, are the presuppositions with which I am working in my science, are they truly Christian? Are they truly scriptural presuppositions? Yes.
When Dooyeweerd says that you cannot lift theoretical schemes of scriptures,
that's right.
Is he saying that scripture therefore does not contain proposition of truth?
Well, that of course has been a sore point in the discussion, has it not? If one means by proposition simply any kind of statement, then of course to say that the scriptures do not contain propositions would be just to give yourself over to some kind of a mysticism or irrationalism or something like that. Well, if anyone takes that position, to my mind, he has taken a very indefensible position.
No, but I said proposition.
Yeah, okay. If one, however, thinks of proposition as that which Vollenhoven has thought of it and as Dooyeweerd has thought about it, as logically qualified statements, or a proposition then of being specifically a theoretical type statement, then they would say, no, you do not find it that way. Otherwise, you would have to go to the scriptures as if it were an exercise in science or logic, and you can't do that. Now, that does have implications for exegesis, indeed. It has implications for biblical anthropology, etc. That is true. But very often, the claim has been made that this position does descend into a mysticism, because the one has failed to see precisely what they mean by proposition. And it is also true that some erstwhile followers and defenders have not made that distinction properly and have fallen into a mysticism. So but to go to the scriptures, I often say, as if it were a chemical abstract or something, I don't think it is. It is, the scripture does not give us, and I think we realize that, all kinds of Reformed theologians have realized, that the scriptures do not give us our systematic theology in just the form that it appears in our books. Now, some say that it does, but I say all kinds of Reformed theologians have understood that it doesn't. Yes?
Where did Doyle get these ideas at the bottom of each?
I beg your pardon?
Where did Doyle get his idea that at the bottom of each science there is a religious foundation if you're not supposed to leave anything to do with the life of the Holy Scriptures? Where did he get that idea from?
Well, he would get it by trying to understand the word God, cosmos, and our place in it, according to the light of God's revelation. Now, if you say, well, where did he get it from? You can look in Scripture, and one of the major factors in his view would be the doctrine of creation. If God then is the creator of all things, if he is a transcendent creator who has brought all things out of nothing by the word of his power and has established man as the crown of his creation and so forth and so on, would you not then expect that man would be a covenant being who is religious through and through, then that the cosmos as God has revealed is centered in man as a covenant being? Well, there is the heart of this view of religion right there. But that idea is itself not theoretical. It would not be theoretical according to this. It would not be. It would be part of the entire equipment that would be at the very root and the very religious root of all theory, that you would have to say all theory then, in order to be carried on properly, must live out of and reflect back on. This is that artichoke business. It lives out of the revelation of God and reflects back on the revelation of God. And but the theoretical construction, they would say you have to use your God-given powers to the best of your ability in response to the divinely given task in the light of his revelation. That's the way they do it. Now, that doesn't agree with everyone who calls himself Reformed, quite correct. But it is, as to my knowledge, in the line of a Calvinistic point of view, but it turns the screw further and tries to get a more radical understanding of man as a covenant being. It's not biblicistic, though. Yes. Could you speak up? We got competition over here.
Yeah, if theoretical thought has a religious root as well as all the sciences,
yes.
Would not then all the aspects have a religious root to them, and therefore are reducible, and we do not have a multiplicity of aspects, but we have one aspect or one mode, the religious mode. Wouldn't that be the case if there is a religious root
well,
in all sciences?
Some people have spoken of the religious as a mode, but I think if you've caught this philosophy, you will see that the modal is in this direction of toward the cosmos in the differentiation, and that it is the religious out of which we see this, and then that which is a religious way in which all these things are grouped together again and seen in their central unity and reflecting back on God who is the creator. To call the religious then a mode would make it one mode among others and deprive it of that central character.
Well, could you argue that there's just one mode, a religious mode?
Well.
And that everything was reduced?
If a person would argue that the religious is the be-all and end-all, then he'd have a pretty awful time explaining himself at breakfast. I mean, he's doing various things there that you just can't all collapse down into, and, you know, it's religious, yes. But what do we mean? We're religious in our eating. We're religious in our conversation. We're religious in this. We're religious in that. Religious in the other. There is a diversity of calling, as Calvin understood. But each one then has a calling from God with a religious significance. There's a diversity. There's a in Calvin, I did some study on this a while back. There's a universal call, but then that is always in terms of the particular calls. And the particular calls are understood in terms of the universal call. Well, Calvin didn't quite go so far as this. But that is more the idea. And we do have a very great diversity in our lives and in our families and everything else. Speaking about the family, I am very amazed, really, how my own children differ one from the other, and how that there is, in terms of their peculiar talents, there's the calling, you know, and the calling is there, and they have to match with the talents and so forth. So there is a terrific diversity in the cosmos, but this idea, it all, as it were, breathes out from God and then reflects back on Him. All right, now we have looked at that then, and this is indeed what you men have been asking about, is one of the sore points in the discussion. And I think part of that rests simply on a misunderstanding and a failure to analyze precisely what these people mean, for one thing, by proposition. But I shall grant you immediately that there have been a lot of sloppy thinking on this, and some people have actually fallen into a very unfortunate type of mysticism, I shall grant you. But that is not, as far as I see it, even suggested by this theory. It's just a mistake that people have been making. All right, if that be so, then I think already one can see how the transcendental thrust in D'Oyebert's thinking is already there. Given your theorizing, you can't simply reduce it to something else. It has its own character. But there is this motion of a transcendental reflection to what is already at work in it. And that is from the very beginning of D'Oyebert's position. So, in the second place then, D'Oyebert held that every possible theoretical position then is led, even in the formation of his theoretical concepts, by an idea of law. We said this before, but I did warn you we'd be reviewing this a little bit. Our second point then, following upon that first one, is that every possible theoretical position is led, even in the formation of his theoretical concepts, by an idea of law. Therefore, he gave his developing philosophy the name of the philosophy of the idea of law, the vice preferred of the Vestide, the philosophy of the idea of law, that there's an idea of law underlying every possible philosophy. Now, interestingly, this idea here has been somewhat lost. Even those who follow along in the camp and even possibly think that they're more D'Oyebertian than Bolenhovian have tended to confuse this transcendental direction with what they call gut reactions. That we have a gut reaction to something. I sense this, or I have a gut reaction to something, and then I develop that idea theoretically, or I develop that feeling or whatever it is theoretically. That is not the way D'Oyebert went at it. He went at it this way, that you have a structure to your theorizing. Every theorizing is led by an idea of law. He gave his philosophy the name of the philosophy of the idea of law. Now, in this original inspiration itself, then, there are traits, as I've suggested, which lead directly into a transcendental type of thinking. I mentioned before that the law idea was regarded by D'Oyebert to be an organon, that is, an instrument which would serve to relate our theoretical thinking and our worldview commitment. The organon is a link. And this idea of law is that of a law order, a death's order, which, given any experience, is already there. This law idea, then, is of a law order, one type or another, which, given any experience, is already there. It holds for every person, thing, or event. And so you can't make a move, can't do a thing, can't experience anything without this law order already being there and impressing itself upon what you do. You can't get away from it. It's divinely given. It is the divinely given order of the creation. Yes?
Explain to me how you tie together with like the concept that you see in Romans 20, that the law is impressed in people's hearts, the fact that when they look at the creation, they see God in the creation, but they suppress it.
Yes.
And the fact that then that's going to be a part of a person's law idea, well, at the same time, it may be in person or a nihilist or something like that, like an ideality.
Well, then,
how does both part of the law at the same time? Because they both are part of the being, am I correct?
Well, if I was trying to get an answer together and you kept on going, which is always dangerous business, I might have lost then the last part of what you were speaking about, but I'll make an attempt here. A nihilist is not simply one then who, rejecting all meaning, has none. Rejecting all structure, has none. That would be at least a popular way of looking at it. But not according to this position, because as I said, if we were looking at Bollenhoven, one does not simply lop off part of the creation of God. Instead, that part of the creation is distorted. So there's a law structure there at all times, but it is distorted because of the direction in which Bollenhoven would say, or the heart stance, or whatever you want to say. Bollenhoven to the left, right, Dooyeweerd according to the heart stance, and so forth and so on, an apostate or true direction. If that be the case, I think it does square in its depth with what we learn in Romans, because Romans presupposes that there is an order. What happens? Why are they suppressing it? Because it's continually impinging upon them. And therefore, they're forcibly trying to hold it down, or as Murray would say, hold it back beyond their line of vision. Now, if the law structure weren't there for the nihilist, he wouldn't have to repress it. See what I mean? So it's constantly impressing itself. Now, the only thing is, you're not going to get the modal theory from the scriptures directly. They don't pretend that. But however, the scriptures do tell us very definitely that there is the right and the left, there is the apostate and the true, and that there is an order. There is even the order in this idea that if you do not worship and serve the Creator who is blessed forever, you're bound to serve the creature and to have your faith function. You don't lose it. But as Bollenhoven says, it's turned in the wrong direction. It's turned in so that you put your trust in those things which are no God at all but an idol. Does that express it?
Yeah, that answers something there. But
all right, that you, I may have lost the second part.
Yeah, you dealt with part of it at least. You said the law idea is given in experience. We have a law idea.
Yes.
And what I'm saying is, it seems to me part of the law idea is that spoken of in Jeremiah, quoted in Hebrew, that the old law that would be rewritten in our hearts, that we know is there, that we suppress through the knowledge, that whole concept. But even when we look at somebody who say is an empiricist or a nihilist, I'm not saying that he does have a law idea, how do you tie the way that he's going to distort the reality of experience? When you're saying, you know, it's a presupposition, but at the same time it's something that he forms as he goes along.
Now, I'm losing you a little bit here, I must say. That may be entirely my fault. But as far as the law which is given by God, let us say at Sinai, or in any manifestation of that kind, the law idea which you have here is broader. Now, it doesn't deny that at all, but it's broader. It is a theory that we and our total beings are covenant beings, and God, from the very word go in the creation, was revealing himself, even as the scripture said, even his eternal Godhead and majesty and Godhead. And then men apostatize. They have to have then the law reiterated, as we say, and so forth, and all kinds of reiterations to it. Now, so one would have to go apologetically, and one has to show in his apologetics, and James Orr has tried this, Fentil has tried it, Dooyeweerd, even though he disclaimed being an apologist, give us ammunition here. You have to show that when the true transcendence point is lost, indeed, one loses himself, as Fentil said of Plato, even if Plato lost himself in his round globe, Calvin, quoting Calvin. So you have to show, by some hook or crook, by some apologetical method, lose the true transcendence standpoint, and you're not going to be able anymore to gain a proper sense of unity, but there will always be working against yourself in your thinking. You'll always be divided up, as Bobbing said, you know, between idealism and realism and this and that and the other thing. Now, there are various kinds of methods that way, but the pattern will be about the same. So I hope at least I have caught the major thrust of your question.
Yeah, you did.
I did. Fine, thank you. All right, now let's get back here a second. You help me to get back on the track here, or I was on the track, I suppose, but at least back on that little section that I was running on. All right, but given any experience then, see, it's already there. Now, that already idea is important for any transcendental notion, because you do anything and it's already there. You have to reflect transcendentally. You think of the illustration again, as I say, when I try to get away from a pragmatically oriented notion that everything is, first of all, a problem to you. You have to adjust, you see. Here comes your wife and she's a problem to you. Here comes your child, she's a problem to you. May well be, but not because of the pragmatist, because then the idea is that life as a whole is a biotical type of adjusting to your environment. But I say, no, my wife is not first of all a problem to me. She may well be, or I to her. I was a problem to her because she wanted to have someone, and someone was supposed to clean the floor in my study today, and I had to take up a whole pile of stuff and put it on my desk, so I can't even sit down there without cleaning it up, which of course is perfect from the housewife's point of view, but terrible from mine. Well, anyway, so that may be a problem, but in the situation, it's that my wife is already my wife, and she has a calling in this situation. I'm already her husband. And when we do anything, we're doing it husband and wife. We're doing it within an order, within a structure. And so, as I've said, I cannot sin as a husband without presupposing something. I sin against my wife or children, and it has a particular qualification. Now, then, one may reflect, then, on the order that is the ground of the possibility of his experiencing. One may reflect upon that. And that is in a transcendental reflection. Now, I mentioned already that this order of law, then, is meaning. It has no being of itself, but it is only out and to its origin. And so, again, anything you do, you have to see that there is this reflecting back. One of the favorite verses is Romans 11:36, of him, through him, and to him are all things. This philosophy has adopted that verse, you might say. And out of God are all things. Through him and his constant upholding of the creation are all things, and all things are to him. Everything is not only out of, but to its origin. Now, it's necessary, then, that this law be understood to reflect back on the origin of meaning, God. It manifests its dependency at every point upon God in his revelation, a revelation that centers in Jesus Christ. So the law is not just happens to be there. It's not general. It's not some abstract thing separated somehow from God in its generality. That is a bone of contention in the literature, even as it has sprung up here around the seminary. Whether, as I approach this from time to time, that the law in its generality, this very general character of it, must mean that it's separated from God. No, I don't believe that at all myself, and it certainly does not belong within this context, because the law reflects back on the origin of meaning God, manifesting its dependency at every point upon God and his revelation, a revelation that centers in Jesus Christ. And so the law is not conceived of on the order of a set of theoretical axioms. The law is not, as it were, a number of propositions of a theoretical character that one might have as if they were geometrical axioms out of which he could then deduce things or that would then be superordinated norms. Not on the order of theoretical actions that might be imposed a priori on experience. That's not so, that they are imposed a priori. That would be involved in the attempt of Bollenhoven and Doivert to avoid neo-Kantianism. Nor are they on the order of generalizations, the result of theoretical abstraction. They're not, then, a priori in the sense of superordinated norms that you get a priori that are imposed, you might say. Nor are they on the order of generalizations, the result of theoretical abstraction, as if then you look at experience and then the laws that you see are abstractions from your experience. It's neither one. Instead, every theoretical axiom or generalization, given any theoretical generalization, each one then must be understood as revealing this law order. And so Doivert, you see, would go back and say, brethren, followers of Kuiper, all right, look at those principles and see that they too need to be analyzed as to their religious foundations. That's in effect what he did. He tried then to be more radical in a covenantal sense. Now they can argue that. You can say, well, Kuiper is right and Doivert is wrong. If you want to do that either in class or on a paper or something like that, you're perfectly free to do so. But I'm just trying to explain where Doivert came from. Now then, another thing. This order is not that of a theory based on logical or logos world order. There's another thing that I have already suggested, that the order is not that of a theory, a logical theory, a logically qualified theory, based on a logical or logos world order. Because in theory, as I've said, we strike the analogical concepts. Go at reality, Doivert says, with your logically qualified theoretical thinking, which there's the antithetic relation. And you're going to strike up against these analogical concepts, and you have then to reflect upon the order which underlies them and in terms of which your theorizing can be meaningful. So even in the analogical concept ideas I've tried to suggest before, there is a reflection upon the God-given order of creation within which these concepts then are meaningful. I have sometimes jokingly said that we have to have at least one commercial an hour, otherwise you will not feel at home in the television generation. I did translate some time back the article of Doivert, or the pamphlet of Doivert, The Analogical Concepts, and I used to call it the biggest bargain over in the bookstore. It was only about 35 or 40 cents. That was a few years back. And now I don't even know whether they have any anymore. But it would be interesting, possibly to some of you, to read Doivert's writing on the analogical concepts, which is in mimeograph form in English. But these require qualification, modally, and they require that you, in the first place, even to think of them, you have to have been attacking the logos idea. And then, if you look at them carefully, you see that they demand also the reflection. Now let's look then, if we have then looked at Doivert's move toward a formalization of the transcendental critique, if we have reviewed then certain original impulses toward this transcendental critique, let's look for just a couple of moments before we break, and we'll continue it after the break, on the original form of the critique. Now, I've mentioned that Doivert early developed the idea that no theoretical conceptualization is neutral. New theory, you have to reflect on its religious foundations, and he regarded the discovery of the religious root of all thought to be the Copernican revolution in his own thinking. No conceptualization is neutral. It is impelled by an idea of the cosmic coherence and of the origin of meaning. At first, he developed a twofold idea, namely the Vetsidei, or the idea of law. All of our theorizing, he said at first, in the very first of his career, has an idea of the origin and then of the cosmic coherence of meaning, of the coherence of the various aspects. And this idea, then, is not one derived from theoretical thought. You by no means can derive such an idea from theoretical thinking. It's of religious origin, and it will then determine the direction of your theoretical thought. And so this is the last thing we shall say before we break. We'll break for 10 minutes. And if anyone thinks he has to go, as I say, near the end of this next hour to get home for the debates, I shall not be insulted. Please don't all leave at once. Please, especially don't rattle your briefcases as you go, if you are going to. But after this statement, we'll break for just a moment. Therefore, given any theoretical conceptualization, it is necessary to reflect on the idea impelling it. Given any theoretical conceptualization, anything, geometry, physics, chemistry, economics, law, even in theology, given any theoretical conceptualization, it is necessary to reflect on the idea impelling it and the religious content of that idea. On the idea impelling it and on the religious content of that idea. And with that, folks, we'll break for 10 minutes.